taking what they can get, is what an upstate New York couple is doing right now. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
Charlene Carpenter lost her job 3 days before Christmas last year. She made high-tech glass lenses at a Corning plant in Canton, New York. Her husband, Randy, had been laid off from a pallet mill 3 months earlier. They're both in their late 40s, and the motto in the Carpenter household this year was...
Simpler is easier. It's better. Probably not easier, but it's better.
That means no cable TV or internet, no big-ticket items. Their single wide trailer, set among dairy farms and hayfields, is humble, cozy, and paid off. Since the layoffs, Randy's found work at the growing Fort Drum Army base an hour away. Charlene collects unemployment.
We have our little splurges every so often, you know, and we'll still go out to dinner once in a while, and I still spend money on the granddaughter.
The bright spot in Charlene's jobless year has been 2-year-old Riley.
We had one. Did you have one?
Yeah. What color is yours?
Charlene and Riley feed each other Tic Tacs and cuddle on a well-worn couch. Charlene watches her granddaughter 2 days a week. And the other days, she tiptoes towards a new career. She took a medical terminology class to become a receptionist in a doctor's office.
I think it was only the first weekend I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? Because it really was pretty intense.
Like laid-off manufacturing workers everywhere, Charlene's skills don't translate well to the desktop job market. She was learning Microsoft Word and Excel as a beginner.
Taking the class made me realize that there were a lot of people that knew a whole lot more than me that would probably get jobs over me.
Did that freak you out a little bit?
I felt inadequate. And then after, like, when the classes, after I started realizing, you know, this is just for me, you know, and it doesn't matter what other people know, it got a lot better.
Job training for training's sake. In that approach, Charlene's in good company.
Okay, don't anybody print for the second. We're going to do a resume.
This is a job training class at the state-run One-Stop WorkSource, where Charlene Carpenter took her medical terminology course. It's where the unemployed come to find jobs. But these days, senior employment coordinator Jean Hansen says the focus is on training.
Because if our focus is on helping people to find jobs, we would have a dismal success rate.
Unemployment's still at 10%. The number of welfare recipients in this rural part of upstate New York has jumped 15 to 20%. Hansen says the scariest thing right now is that people like Charlene Carpenter will be running out of jobless benefits soon. Hansen predicts a tsunami of job seekers.
They want to work, you know, they want to pay their bills, they're going to lose their unemployment insurance, and there is not going to be a job for each and every one of those people.
Back at the Carpenters, Charlene's daughter Carissa picks up Riley, and she rolls her eyes at the box of sugary Tic Tacs.
She's feeling very privileged.
I bet so.
It was Carissa who needled her mother to take the medical terminology class and look for office work in the first place.
I mean, you could always rely on McDonald's to hire you, but if they're losing sales, they're not even going to be hiring. So even you can't even get one of the, pardon it, what, crap jobs anymore, you know?
Charlene still holds out hope that the Corning plant might rehire her. If not, she might just forget the job search and take care of Riley full-time. With Randy's job at Fort Drum and their simple lifestyle, she says they're doing okay. The Carpenter's biggest fear is if one of them gets sick. They make too much to qualify for New York's low-income health insurance.
I don't know how you want to say it. I'm just gliding along, waiting to see what happens. It's so uncertain. What could be good today could turn upside down tomorrow, so.
And how are you with that?
Scared. I mean, I lose sleep over it, honestly, but you just have to keep your head level, I guess.
It's the only way, Charlene says, when a job may be too much to wish for. For NPR News, I'm David Summerstein in Northern New York.
There were plenty of scandals outside the business world in 2009, but commentator John Ridley says not all of them deserved the attention we gave.
They seemed so important at the time, didn't they?
The breaking news over which much blogging was blogged and cable TV careers were made. But as 2009 gets ready to jump its own shark, what seemed monumental then, in retrospect, has all the significance of a Michael Steele press release. So before they're buried in the Potter's Field of Time, let's take a look back on some of the top non-troversies of 2009. The other shoe in the Palin resignation. Remember that huge scandal that was gonna almost just about pretty much for sure break days after Sarah Palin left office? She was pregnant with John Edwards' love child or something like that. Still waiting for it. Come on, haters. There are better reasons to dislike Palin than her early resignation. Skip Gates versus Sergeant Crowley. What happens when an arrogant object meets an overzealous force? Welcome to post-racial America. Carrie Prejean's Miss U.S. Odyssey. Did anyone really care about the answer to a question on a social issue that a woman in bikini and high heels at a beauty pageant gave to an internet blogger who makes his living drawing phallic symbols on celebrity photos? Obama, the teleprompter president. The saw Obama overuses a teleprompter only slightly beat out the Bo wasn't a rescue pooch non-story. And by the way, the birther stuff was so not anything, it couldn't even make the list. Reality TV scandals. From John and Kate to the Balloon Boy family to the Party Crashers, reality TV stars and wannabes prove that truth has more issues than fiction, and fame is best left to those who can handle it, like well-adjusted Hollywood celebrities. A wise Latina. You know, that's the kind of stupid remark you'd think only a dumb white guy could make. Le Fair Tiger. So let me get this straight. A rich young athlete cheats on his former bikini model ex-nanny wife. This is really what dominated the news cycle the same week the president announced his new strategy for the war in Afghanistan and Congress inched closer to universal health care. Congrats, America. You've officially proved your disdain for the relevant. Now, it's been quite a year of overhyped extraneousness, hasn't it? So here's hoping that your 2010 is filled with nothing but significance.
Commentator John Ridley is head writer for The Wanda Sykes Show. You can comment on his essay on the opinion page at NPR.org. We're heading into a year in which Congress may change the health care system. Sometimes, though, a change in health care does not take a change in the law. NPR's Richard Knox spoke with a Boston doctor who recalls a patient who changed the way she practices medicine.
A couple of years ago, Suzanne Mitchell was in a funk. Her research wasn't going anywhere, and she was burned out by her hectic practice.
I've been in settings that are brutally busy and can really drain the physician just by the sheer number of patients you have to see every day. And I think that was part of what led me to this crisis in my career is that, you know, what am I doing here?
To give herself time to take stock, she took a part-time job in Gloucester, an old fishing port north of Boston. Her first patient she visited at home.
The door opened and I saw this older gentleman with his dog beside him, defending him fiercely.
The man's name was Dick. He was a guy who didn't like doctors.
An old New England salt. Had a beard like the Gloucester fisherman. All he needed was a pipe and a hat, I think, and a peacoat. Very independent-minded, a little bit gruff. If it needs to be done, I can do it myself.
Dick ran his own heating supply business until he got very sick with an intestinal problem. He had some bad experiences in the hospital, and then he got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. By that time, he was so fed up that he didn't see a doctor for years.
Which I found astonishing that anyone could manage to avoid the healthcare system after 20 years from being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
But Dick was having problems walking. His wife had health problems of her own, so they called for help. Dr. Mitchell ordered routine blood tests. They showed anemia. A further workup, x-rays, a CAT scan, showed a tumor in his kidney. Specialists decided to check it again in 3 months. Meanwhile, Dick's MS got worse. His family summoned Dr. Mitchell for another house call.
I looked at him from across the room, and I just knew that he was really in a crisis. And I walked over and I knelt down in front of him and I looked him in the eye. And I knew in my heart that I was taking a chance. And I said, "Dick, you need to go to the hospital. You need to go to the hospital." He looked at me and he said, "Okay." And I knew then that he had placed his trust in me.
But once he was in the hospital, things didn't go well. The doctors wanted to treat his kidney cancer aggressively. Dick just wanted to go home.
He was at this time very ornery and unhappy with me, and he didn't trust me anymore, and he just kept telling me to bring him home, bring him home.
Mitchell realized then that she'd made a mistake by putting him in the hospital. But that decision turned out to be incredibly difficult to reverse. Some family members didn't think they could care for him at home. Mitchell's colleagues questioned her judgment. But she kept pushing to get him home, and she prevailed.
We brought him home on Christmas Eve, and all of his family was there, his children, his grandchildren, his dog, his wife. It was the first time he smiled, I think, in months. And 6 hours later, he passed away at home.
Which is where he wanted to be all along. Mitchell says Dick taught her the difference between medical treatment and medical care.
To be willing to follow your patient to where they want to go is an uncomfortable journey, and it changed me forever.
How are you different now?
I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to allow my patients to take me on their journey. Whatever expertise we have, the patient holds the wisdom of their life, and we need to be with our patients, really be with them.
Mitchell tells this story to medical students and young doctors in training. Sometimes they say, "How will we have time to get to know our patients?" Her response is, "You can't afford not to, not if you're going to be a good doctor." Richard Knox, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Southern Ontario Gothic literature is one of Canada's cultural gifts to the world. You're not sure what Southern Ontario Gothic is? Well, think of the Southern American Gothic writers, William Faulkner, Harper Lee, Tennessee Williams, with their focus on race, sexuality, and religion, and then move them to Southern Ontario, and you get Alice Munro. She's written a new collection of short stories called Too Much Happiness, and Alan Chews has our review.
I'm not the kind of reader or short story writer who puts much stock in exposition, but I sit still for Alice Munro's explanatory passages every time. She lays down such seemingly ordinary but useful sentences, one after another after another. Though I come to scoff, I stay to marvel. Munro's expositions hold worlds of story material in themselves. There's this from near the opening of the story called Fiction. She writes, "In their first year at college, they dropped out of their classes and ran away together. They got jobs here and there, traveled by bus across the continent, lived for a year on the Oregon coast, were reconciled at a distance with their parents, for whom a light had gone out in the world. The ironies of living a long life, with all of its twists and turns, abound in this story, including the main character's initial disdain for the short story form itself. Is there anyone writing short fiction today in English who has more authority? But as safely settled inside the gates of literature as she may be, Munro advances her art in this current collection, with its cast of lovers and losers, husbands and widows, scientists, and people who labor with their hands. In the story called Wood, we learn about the bite of a life working with bark. Ironwood, that heavy and reliable firewood," she writes, "has a shaggy brown bark. Cherry is the blackest tree in the bush, and its bark lies in picturesque scales. Ash is a soldierly tree with a corduroy ribbed trunk. The descriptions go on. And if this is what she does with trees in these stories, you can imagine what she does with people."
Alice Munro's new book is called Too Much Happiness. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University.